Friends of the Earth International and Real World Radio present their special show, COVID-19, The People's Path from Crisis to Recovery.
To today's discussion. It's really great to have you here and to be meeting here today to discuss the COVID-19 pandemic and the impacts that this huge thing has had in communities across the world. The aim of this show and this discussion is that we're going to share some experiences and some knowledge about how communities and organizations are dealing with the impacts of COVID-19 on the ground in the territories and exploring what kind of strategies peoples have been using to take care of one another, to care for one another's health and well-being during this difficult year. And we'll also be exploring some of the politics behind it all, so the political analysis and a systemic analysis underlying the emergence of the pandemic and the unequal impact it's had across the world. So our discussion today brings together people from Friends of the Earth groups in three different regions and allied organizations. So joining us today, we have Jamie, who's the Director of Campaigns at Friends of the Earth England, Wales and Northern Ireland in Europe. We have Amos from Friends of the Earth Ghana, who coordinates the Energy Justice and Climate Change Program. We also welcome Mina Rahman, who is actually the former chair of Friends of the Earth International and is currently with Friends of the Earth Malaysia and the Third World Network. Also joining us is Jason, who is in the Philippines. He's from the Philippine Eagle Foundation and collaborates with the ICA Consortium. And he works with the Obu Manufu Indigenous Peoples and several other Indigenous groups in the Philippines. I'm Madeline Reyes. I'm from the communications team at Friends of the Earth International. And I will hand over to my comrade Jose, who is with Friends of the Earth International and Real World Radio team. And he's going to get us started with a question.
Thank you, Madeline, for the introduction. I'm also here with Cesar. He's our guy in the controls, taking care of the audio of this show. Welcome also to our participants. And I would like to launch the questions. So the first thing would be, what were the impacts of COVID-19 in your territories, both in terms of the health impacts and the impacts of the government responses to the crisis?
In many countries in Asia, whether it began with China or whether it was Vietnam or whether it was Taiwan, South Korea and so on, and even in Malaysia, Singapore also, I think many of our governments actually came down with quite dramatic and drastic measures in terms of introducing lockdowns. Now, I think this was actually quite good. I think the notion here of the collective rights and the larger public interest, I think, was actually quite important. So for Malaysia, at least, I think the health authorities took the right step. And for a country like Malaysia, quite earlier on, we managed to bring the numbers down. And public health access to the facilities was actually quite good when we look at it in the sense of the history of why some countries are coping better and others are not coping as well. A very major factor is actually whether these countries were following totally neoliberal agendas, primarily because of loan conditionalities which prevented the state from investing in public health. So I think that's a very major lesson. So one of the big problems, actually, apart from the health impacts, is the impact on the poorer communities, people, particularly those in the low income situation, particularly small businesses that actually suffer because of the fact that the economy was literally shut down. Another population that actually suffered quite a lot in terms of the health and were the first to not have access to healthcare facilities were actually the migrant communities, the migrant workers. In many parts of our world here, we have large numbers of migrant workers. And you particularly saw this in Indonesia, in Singapore, and even in Malaysia, my own country, and even in India, when the government announced a lockdown and then massive numbers of people having to walk miles back to their villages, you know, because there was no jobs in the cities. So these were some of the negative impacts. Of course, the government introduced stimulus packages because at least Malaysia is a middle-income country. It's able to pump in some stimulus moneyed. So one final point I'll make is in terms of the impact on our own work. Friends of the Earth Malaysia actually works a lot on the with the grassroots communities. One of our main constituencies is actually the indigenous peoples in the forest in Sarawak, for instance, which is in East Malaysia. We have not been able to go there during the lockdown. And even our staff who are in East Malaysia do have restrictions in terms of where they can go. So there are these impacts in terms of reaching to the communities who may be having special problems. And the internet access in these areas are not exactly good. In a rich world, you have fiber optics, you have digital technology, people can access and you can have Zoom virtual lessons. So this whole rich digital divide is another issue. Connectivity is another issue. And, you know, not being able to go down on the field to assist the poorer communities is an issue.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's so many different aspects you covered. You know, there's this clear divide in the impacts between rural and urban spaces, and this in return to a more kind of slow, family-focused lifestyle, especially in affluent spaces. But then also this widening of the gap between wealthy and poor, with poor communities, migrant communities kind of made even more vulnerable. They tend to be in more frontline, more insecure jobs, and then they have more difficulties connecting digitally because internet can be expensive for many places. So thank you for sharing. I'd like to pass over to Amos Yesutembo from Ghana.
From our end of the world, the situation in Ghana has not been too different from the prevailing situation in other African countries with respect to COVID-19. In terms of government response, initially, the government of Ghana decided to allocate $100 million to enable the state infrastructure to be able to fight against COVID-19. And there have been some measures that have been put in place. From a health perspective, the government has decided to construct an additional intensive care unit in Accra to cater for the additional pressure or the number of cases from the COVID-19 infections. The government has also established an economic relief or financial relief to small and medium-scale enterprises in Ghana, which is giving some small or soft loans to small and medium-scale enterprises to ensure that they are able to stay in business during this period. But in spite of these responses, Ghana has still suffered a huge impact resulting from COVID-19. I think from an economic perspective, from a recent study that was done in August, 770,000 workers in Ghana have been laid off between March and August as a result of COVID-19, which means that all of these people would have to either go and stay in the house or look for a different way of meeting their daily needs. So economically, that has been the major blow, that the laying off of people. But apart from that, the survey also indicates that about 90% of businesses in Ghana indicate that they have recorded a loss in sales, or their revenue per month has reduced as a result of the impacts of COVID-19. But the indirect impacts are also happening. Basically, in Ghana, we are seeing the indirect impacts of COVID-19 in terms of resource management or resource utilization, resource extraction. We are seeing a number of people moving back into rural areas and going into illegal mining activities. So illegal mining has been a major problem for Ghana over the years. But due to the COVID-19, the loss of jobs, the youth who have lost their jobs, who are with like the oil companies and others, are now moving back to the rural area, and they are going into illegal activities, specifically illegal mining activities. And this is devastating our water bodies, our ecosystems, and our forests in Ghana. Apart from that, the youth are also going into illegal logging activities. Illegal logging is harvesting timber without the right permit or without a permission. So that is another major problem that is destroying our forest in Ghana. As you know, Ghana has recently become one of the oil producing countries in Africa. We started producing oil in commercial quantities in 2010, and currently most of our oil extraction activities have been offshore. But in 2016, there was a proposal to do an onshore oil project, which from observations is likely to have significant impacts on our ecosystem, on the livelihoods of local communities around the site in that particular area. So COVID has impacted oil production in a major way. Up till now, there have been some resistance with regard to that project because of its implications for local communities and then ecosystem. But because of the COVID situation, we have the fear, or there is a concern, that government is likely to expedite that project and get it started without following the needed consultations, or without getting the consent of the local communities or other stakeholders that are involved. And not only that, there is also the concern that government is likely to look for other ways of raising revenue without taking into consideration its environmental and social implications for the people that are likely to be affected. So these are some of the indirect impacts that I wanted to highlight.
Thank you, Amos. I think you have introduced a new category, very important for this debate, which is the consequences of the pandemic, but also of the responses from the government for the workers all over the world. In Ghana, but it's the same, which is happening everywhere. So the layoffs of workers is something which is very concerning for several organizations, for the different social movements all over the world, and particularly for the unions, especially in the countries where there is no strong social support from behind, from the state, to help those workers. So I would like to go now with Jamie Peters. Jamie, could you please tell me if you, in Friends of the Earth, England, Wales and Northern Ireland, have taken special healthcare measures with the communities or inside the organization to protect yourselves? And I would like to connect that with the question if you have run any kind of educational or communications strategy to help the people cope with this pandemic. Thank you, Jamie.
Yeah, thanks, Jose. Hello to everyone. You know, first, touch upon what we've done as an organisation, sort of internally. We're quite a big organisation within the Friends of the Earth community and have around 160 or so staff around the country. So we decided quite early that we would stop staff coming into the office. That was maybe two weeks, I think, before the UK announced a national lockdown. So we made that decision because we could see what was happening in places like Italy and Spain, which really felt huge impacts sooner than we did in the UK. We were on the same trajectory. And really since then, we've essentially had no staff in our offices. I'm currently sitting in our office just now, but I'm one of only two people in a very big office. And we've had to adapt to home working very quickly. Internally, we've tried to do an awful lot to support staff. People have had different experiences of working from home. We've tried to set that up for people to be comfortable as possible, and as well trying to connect staff, because I think we can all relate to the mental impact the impact on our mental health of working in the same place and not being able to go outside for large parts of the lockdown. I think that was the early stage for us. You could only go out of the home for exercise once a day or to collect essential items that you needed to buy, or unless you were a key worker. So that's what we did internally. We've tried to maintain that support for staff and try to provide those connections that you don't have when you're no longer in an office speaking to each other. So looking outside of what we did internally during this time, the priority for Friends of the Earth has been to ensure the safety of our network. So our local Friends of the Earth groups, or climate action groups, of which we've got over 200, and obviously to ensure the safety of the wider society that we engage with. So we tried to take the appropriate steps to look at what that actually meant, how we can protect people, particularly those most vulnerable to COVID-19, and protect their own people or those with underlying health conditions. So we set up guidelines for our groups, which we were trying to base, of course, on the government guidelines. We made a few initial steps. We stopped in-person events and activities, of course. Basically, a lot of our campaigns were set up with in-person events and activities, sort of core. So that had quite a big impact on what we're actually trying to do as an organisation, but we stopped those. We tried to then carry out a number of training webinars with our network to show how they can move to online events, how they can move to online meetings with each other. So we tried to really focus on training people on that, ensuring that local and national guidance has been followed. We also carried out some training internally and externally on how we talk about the crisis, completely unprecedented times that we're living in. And we really wanted to be sensitive about how we communicated that as an environmental organisation. One of the dangers that we felt in the United Kingdom in our context was for sort of areas of the media, which we did see, to try to claim that these were environmental victories at Friends of the Earth we celebrate them. I live in London and I noticed an improvement in the air quality, but we're very careful not to try to portray those as any sort of success and place them in a context of a horrific pandemic going through the country and globally. And then we did an awful lot of work on digital campaign and resources to show what people could do offline. We've been doing a week of action this week, actually, and we have had to make that online. We're very lucky, Friends of the Earth England, Wales and Northern Ireland do have a lot of staff resource and do have the ability to create these digital resources, so recognise the privilege we've got for that, and we've shifted the way that we campaign to that. And then ultimately we wanted to show that we stood in solidarity with groups and other communities who have been affected here. This is not pandemic that has affected people the same way. It's not a pandemic, it's been proportionate. We've also been working in coalition with a broad coalition with groups such as healthcare workers. All of a sudden we're seeing that the key workers were the people that were driving the buses, that were the nurses for the National Health Service. They might be key workers, but certainly haven't been valued by the government. So trying to stand up for their rights and make sure we're not just calling out for environmental rights, but calling out for social justice rights and making sure that's linked with things that really matter to people. I think that COVID has really brought to the surface leading inequalities in our society. So making sure that Friends of the Earth's position itself is a champion for those, rather than just talking about climate change or environmental issues, but showing how they're connected, about how these different injustices intersect.
Thanks very much, Jamie. I'd like to pass over to Jason Ibanez in the Philippines to ask a similar question. I mean, working with Indigenous peoples and local communities in the Philippines, has your organisation run any special communication strategy or education to help these people cope with the specific impacts they face?
Thanks, Madeline, for that question. Yeah, as a conservation NGO that has been working with Indigenous communities across the Philippines for over 2 decades now, one of our major responses was to help Indigenous communities cope. And one such strategy is, of course, giving them access to information as well as support despite the lockdowns and quarantine. So we all know that social media and digital technology has been very useful sources. So what we did was to bring webinars as well as facilitate social media or online platforms so that communities can access this information. So such information and support included, you know, getting tips on financial management under the new normal. So we had 3 pilot communities undertaking webinars. So we have the resource persons online and then organized communities, you know, under strict, of course, social distancing and hygiene protocols, listen and get tips and have a conversation with the external experts. You know. So we've also facilitated interaction between experts on gender and development, and particularly with Indigenous women. Now, there are also cases of physical abuse and sexual harassment in the uplands. So our modest way of, you know, increasing awareness and support is, again, through these webinars. No? And then, as you well know, because of the impacts of the pandemic, face-to-face education by kids and minors are now disallowed. So in the Philippines, they have instituted, they call it blended learning, while in some schools, they strictly adopted modular approaches. You know, the modules sent by school to the parents, and then the parents would facilitate the learning of their kids. But then this is very challenging for Indigenous parents, you know, especially since not all of them are formally educated. So part of our intervention now is to, again, get the help of external educators, provide capacity building sessions with, again, Indigenous women, because in the Philippines, Philippines, most of the task or role to teach kids fall in the hands or shoulders of the women parents. And then we've also tapped our corporate partners to provide computers and also laptops, desktops, and then tablets, and then train these parents to use them so that they could also in turn use it to facilitate the learning of their kids. And then also one of the things we did was to help indigenous leaders, their councils, revisit their management plans. In the Philippines, you have the rights or you have the legal ownership over the ancestral domain. You have to come up with your ancestral domain sustainable development and protection plan. So what we did was facilitate a revisit of this plan and then re-strategize in the light of the new normal. One of the challenges, especially among indigenous communities in the Philippines, particularly in the communities that we work with, is that they're practically badly hurt by the lockdowns and quarantines. You know, contrary to the belief, and this is still exists in the Philippines, among the public and in towns and cities, that the indigenous peoples are self-sufficient, you know? They're still dependent on subsistence, livelihood. They're very much dependent on the modern market or the mainstream market, again, for the trade of their produce and also manual labor. So when with the lockdowns and the quarantines, income totally stopped, they could not go to work. And many of them are actually daily income earners. No? They don't have savings. They have very little assets, physical assets. When the lockdown arrived and the quarantines, which substantially banned travel and then trade, there was very little opportunity for income generation. And interestingly, you know, part of the culture also of the indigenous peoples, no, as they have experienced, no, they are very familiar with pandemics, and part of their protocol is self-isolation whenever similar diseases happen in their communities. So immediately after the March 2020 lockdowns and quarantines, almost all of them went up to the mountains and isolated themselves. But then again, because of, you know, they become detached to the main market, there was no income, there was practically no money to buy food, there was hunger in the uplands. There were even cases that community partners called us, contacted us, you know, asking help.
Jason, thank you very much. And I would like to take the opportunity to ask you if the local communities or social organizations in the country have witnessed or experienced an increase in threats as a result of the pandemic. For example, with the persecution of activists and defenders.
I believe across the Philippines there are cases of threats and persecution of especially of indigenous leaders fighting for their ancestral domains. This has been happening even before the COVID-19 pandemic. And I've also heard of some cases about disputes between indigenous communities and mining companies, and some leaders, you know, getting murdered because of this. And then also cases of, you know, indigenous communities within the COVID-19 pandemic filing cases, you know, against government officials and mining companies violating their ancestral land rights. No, but fortunately, in the places that we work with, we don't have these cases, but we do have cases of continuous land grabbing of ancestral domain. Other threats include continuous timber poaching within ancestral domains, and also wildlife poaching. I think that's one of the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. Life is really hard in the uplands, so illegal activities are proliferating as we speak. More timber poaching is happening, and then cases of illegal wildlife trade is happening.
Thanks very much, Jason. It's really interesting to hear about those really specific experiences in the Philippines for those communities. I'd like to move on to think a bit more about the kind of political analysis of the crisis. And we wanted to ask, what do you think the impacts of the COVID-19 crisis tells us about the current socio-economic political system?
Well, the scale at which the pandemic, it became a pandemic worldwide, what this actually so shows is that in a globalized world, which is connected like this at the moment with the movement of peoples and also the supply chains, as they talk about, that one problem in a particular part of the world can get transmitted with such ease and such speed. And what it did also show is that governments were totally unprepared for this. I think the warnings, and many of us have been giving the warnings about how we should not be, you know, encroaching into the forest and so on. And already we know that there are many, many viruses which are in the ecosystem, which are going to be revealed more and more if we encroach into habitats which should not be touched on. So this is actually the breaking of the ecosystem, I think, which is another big lesson that what it can do in terms of the virus spread. This actually throws light on the climate change issue. When you have the melting of the ice sheets and the permafrost thawing, you know, viruses and other bacteria and other species which are buried under the ice for literally many millions of years, suddenly being exposed to the world. So I do think that we are going to see the emergence of more and more of this kind of diseases, which we are totally unprepared for because of the onslaught of the current system on the ecosystem. So it actually is a signal that the world is out of sync, particularly that in the way in which we have used resources, with the rich plundering a lot of the resources at the expense of the poor. So I think the pandemic has actually shown that you cannot take the environment lightly anymore. And the other thing that it actually has exposed to, which I also alluded to before, is that countries who could respond were countries where the state apparatus actually had investments that it could use to help its people, particularly in the health sector, or even to provide some kind of social safety nets. Where it failed is actually where the state has receded, where you have governments which were cut back due largely to the rollback of the state, primarily because of, as I said, the conditionalities imposed by the IMF and the World Bank with structural adjustment and so on. And so in many of these countries, they couldn't cope. This shows actually that the system is in massive crisis, that until and unless we invest in the public sector and not treat the public sector as the enemy and treat the private sector as the master, I think the neoliberal agenda has shown us that the policies don't work, and that when you have a crisis like this, it actually makes the poor even poorer and the vulnerable even more vulnerable. But the final point that I'd like to make is also this issue about the access to the vaccines and the medicines and the protective gear and all the materials that we need for coping with COVID. One of the biggest problems with that is actually the whole worry about the patenting of medicines. And this is something that the Third World Network and all of us work on, where the WTO TRIPS agreement, trade in intellectual property rights, which has actually made it very difficult for many of the medicines to actually be obtained cheaply and affordably. And so we fear that such imposition, the patent system around the world, will actually prevent the access of affordable vaccines and medicines and equipment that is needed. So civil society and social movements have made a strong call that this kind of, you know, TRIPS agreement should not be allowed in a time of a crisis like this. Actually, we were all against it anyway, but particularly in this particular moment in time, the private sector should not be allowed to benefit from it because of the public emergency. I think we are really have to have a lot of lessons from this crisis. And until and unless we have the entire system change agenda of the right kind in the forefront of our policies and decision making, we worry that we will just go back to business as usual, and we will be responding to another crisis that will hit us again of proportions that we will not have again expected.
Thank you, Mina. Anyone that would like to follow?
Yeah, Jose, maybe it's Jamie here, just to say a few words. I think Mina's got the spot on, but very quickly for myself, I think it shows the lack of resilience in the current neoliberal system. We see these shocks, it's COVID this time, but 2008, it was a huge recession from the failures of the banking system. And again, it's up to governments, it's up to the state to step in to provide the real support. In our country, in the UK, it's been the National Health Service, which is obviously publicly owned. That's something that many people have been fighting for, been worried about it being privatised for a long time. It's been underfunded for a long time, and it's been the thing that people have valued most over this whole COVID pandemic. So I think it shows the failing of this reliance on the private sector in many ways, and how we do rely on these key workers, which are state workers. We've seen the government have to step in with job saving schemes, which again is state money, which private firms have been accessing to ensure that there's no job losses. And we've also seen the state aid being used inappropriately in terms of huge bailouts to polluting industries, to the aviation industry, for instance. Some of these companies have been handed out millions of pounds to shareholders shortly before asking for government money to fund themselves. It's frankly unacceptable. So I think it tells us that the system wasn't working. It doesn't work. It's not resilient to shocks. And it constantly needs the state to bail it out. And this is the setup that we have. It's not for far too long, our economy's benefited a small group of people at the expense of the poorest and most vulnerable. And that's what we've seen before, it's what we're seeing again. And this certainly does present a huge crisis, and there should be an opportunity to readdress that, which we might come on to later. But I think it shows the fragility of the current system, and that this sort of hyper-neoliberal way of our country working doesn't provide for everyone. People don't want to go back to normal because it wasn't providing before for everyone before COVID does.
Thanks, Jamie. Would anyone else would like to reflect on the ways in which governments have supported either health systems in the country or region, or how governments have dealt with the kind of economic fallout of the pandemic?
Yes. Well, I can say that, you know, perhaps in contrast to the situation in Malaysia, no, as shared by Nina, and perhaps similar to what is happening in Ghana, no, as shared by Amos, the Philippines in general and its health system was not ready to face this crisis. So the response was sort of slow and really inadequate, no, and primarily because of the lack of resources and medical facilities. No, for instance, hospitals alone in the Philippines are really very inadequate. We have less than 1,500 hospitals across the country, and 65% of these are basically private hospitals. So you can easily see that hospital care is a luxury, no, here in the Philippines. The health system is really, pre-COVID, is really inadequate to meet these challenges.
Thank you, Jason. That's really interesting to reflect on, yeah, how different the healthcare systems are in different countries and regions, and obviously the different kinds of access to healthcare that people have. I just wanted to comment that it's really a shame that we've lost Amos, who was in Ghana, and it just makes me think, you know, it's kind of almost a perfect example of this digital divide and the difficulties everything going digital and everything going online has for people to be able to access, to be part of conversations. I mean, I know across the African region, there's lots of connectivity issues, and Wi-Fi and data can be very expensive. It happened exactly even in this call that we've lost the voice of our African comrade because he was having connectivity issues. That's a shame.
Totally agree with you, Madeleine, and the difficulties with the connection. And also it has to do with a reflection about what things can really be done online and what can't be done online. And I would like, as you said, Maddie, to move ahead with the next questions, which would be for Jamie, please. Could you reflect on the unequal consequences of the pandemic and also about the measures taken to address it, the different consequences and the different impacts that those measures have inside the societies, but also if you compare continents? Please, Jamie, go ahead.
The direct impacts of coronavirus, job losses. I think Nina explained that the government scheme to maintain jobs, which we've had here, but that's running out this year, and not all communities, not all people are able to sustain a loss of income, sustain losing their job, as well as others. So it is going to drive inequality. I think you mentioned globally, Jose, there's a disproportionate ability for governments to respond to this, the same way there's a disproportionate ability for governments to respond to climate change. What you're seeing is the global north, many of the sort of colonial countries that have the wealth been taken from global south in many cases, that are better equipped to pour money into their own economies. So you're going to see huge disproportionate impact globally. And I think we've not even seen the tip of that yet, Jose, unless we really treat this virus as an example of how we have to work across borders, how we have to stand in solidarity with those most impacted. Unless we use it as an opportunity to reduce inequalities. Again, I think this is where a lot of us in this call, a lot of our organisations have been calling for the same in terms of response to climate change. There has to be a focus on communities. It has to be a focus on justice. And to do that, it's not enough just to look at your own country. So you'd hope that the countries with the most resources are going to be working to provide that support, whether it's health support, whether it's economic support, or whether it's just looking at how we want to build back our national and our global economies. Do we want to go back to polluting jobs? Do we want to actually invest in clean infrastructure? Do we want to invest in, for instance, more cycling here? Do we want to invest in building, decarbonising our energy system, creating new long-term sustainable jobs? So I think we have to treat this as an opportunity about working cross-border, because there's a real danger that we're going to see inequalities continue to rise within our own countries, but the impact of that globally could be devastating.
Thank you, Jamie. It's so important what you say, just the importance of solidarity at this kind of moment. You know, this is something that we're not facing as individual countries or as individual people. And, you know, it's a global pandemic with global roots, causes a part of a kind of globalized system. And we're all facing the impacts together, but very much unevenly in different ways. I wanted to ask Nina if she could reflect, as you already started doing, Jamie, on the possibility of a just recovery from COVID-19. And how can we use this opportunity or this moment to build perhaps an alternative to the current system, or to kind of build back a better world than the one we were in? Could you reflect on that, please, Mina?
Yeah, well, the question is easy, but the answer is very hard, as we all know. And so I think at least at the national level, many of us, our organizations have been doing advocacy work and pushing our governments and so on to actually do the right thing in terms of not going business as usual, but actually ensuring that they learn from this and do what is needed, such as not bailing out corporations, such as helping the poorer sections of our society, such as ensuring that people are able to feed themselves, recognize all the solutions that we have been talking about for a long time in terms of environmentally sustainable solutions, from sustainable agriculture to protection of the forest to recognizing indigenous people's rights. I mean, all the options that Friends of the Earth and its members around the world have been campaigning on in terms of every facet of our economy and every facet of our lives. So that's one thing that I think what Friends of the Earth has been campaigning on internationally and nationally has become more relevant today than ever, because we have to go through to sustainable solutions, because what this has shown is that if we chart the recovery on the same path that got us to where we are in the first place, there's not going to be a recovery of the right kind. In fact, it's a disaster waiting to happen. So I do think that this presents a great opportunity for a lot more of our advocacy and initiatives that we have been promoting, even on the ground onwards with community livelihoods and community systems and so on, to actually show the response to how, if we live in a balance with the ecosystem, it can actually also help support lives and livelihoods. Critical to this is international cooperation, because what we have seen is that many, many of the poor countries are not able to cope anymore, and a looming, in fact, there's already a debt crisis which is happening. So far, what we have seen the rich world do is basically to say that they will reschedule the payments, postpone the payments of the debt by these poor countries. But we should actually be cancelling the debt. We should not be promoting further debt. So that's one thing that we need to do. And we need to have financial measures of a massive kind, like the Global Marshall Plan, for the right kind of development, not the wrong kind of development, but real sustainable development in the developing countries to address the pandemic, as well as to make sure that they are able to provide jobs to their people, move to a just transition, meaning moving away from dependence on fossil fuels, but actually do the kind of a green path that we all want to go towards. These are some of the very important lessons that we have learned. We cannot go the same business as usual approach, and the system change solutions that we've been calling for are really overdue, long overdue in all the sectors. So I do think that is possible. And I think Friends of the Earth can really step up together with all our social movements, because I think there is an appetite now, particularly among the people who are affected, to look at a different kind of a world, not the same world that has led to where we are.
Thank you, Mina. Jason's been having some problems with very heavy rain in where he is, but he might want to add something. Let's see how the audio is. Go ahead, Jason.
I hope this works. So regarding the question on alternatives to the current system and the possibility of a just recovery from COVID-19, well, in the case of indigenous peoples in the Philippines, I believe the government, both national and local, can really help them with a just recovery. And I believe that investing more on livelihood opportunities as well as green jobs for indigenous peoples in the uplands would be the way forward. You know, this is very much relevant in the face of this pandemic and the potential of other novel diseases, you know, happening in the future. And then we believe that, again, to increase the resilience of the country against future pandemics and novel diseases, there should be investments in saving as much of the forest that's left. And that's where indigenous peoples can be of help and can gain a niche for a decent job. You know, we believe that engaging indigenous peoples in the uplands as forest guards or as carers of the forest, as forest rangers, and then paying them decently could alleviate their situation. And this is where the government, by reallocating or subsidizing the engagement of indigenous peoples through green job generation, this can potentially take them out of the of poverty while at the same time protect our natural resources and enhance the country's resilience against future pandemics as well as the negative impacts of global climate change.
Thank you, Jason. We would like also to hear your perspective, Jamie, about the possibilities for a just recovery from this pandemic and the chances that it opens to create another system, another world in which we could live in better conditions, especially in terms of justice, social justice, economic justice, gender justice. Please, Jamie.
One thing we've all been calling for in our struggle and the climate change movement has been, you know, for clean jobs, for investment in renewable energy. And one of the barriers we face for a lot of the things that we've called for has been there's no money to do this. If anything, COVID has taught us is that possibilities are there. So when there's a huge crisis that faces humanity, we can find the money. So this is a possibility for us. It's about choices now. We know that there could be money found. The economy's taken a real beating over coronavirus, but when there's huge challenges, we can come together, we can, or we need to come together. We need to address these issues. So that can provide some sort of hope when I look at these things. There is no return to normal. I don't think there's an appetite to return to normal. People want their freedom and their liberty back, but I don't think they want to fall back into where we were before, an economic system that wasn't working for all of us. So I think we can, I can have a little bit of hope in my heart when I look at that, about what we want to build back better. I think this, as I mentioned, this virus has brought to the surface the inequalities, but it's also brought to the surface the people that really matter in society, the people that are really getting impacted and how we have to stand in solidarity with them. I think this is an opportunity for us to have societies that are more equal, to create those jobs where they're needed. So building that resilient economy, looking at what our true values are, I think is a really important thing here. For too long, very few people have benefited from our economy. Far too many things that should be human rights, such as health, have been privatised. So building back with a focus on justice, a focus on community, a focus on kindness, and creating the positive aspects of international solidarity. I think this is one of the few times we've all been hit with an immediate risk around the world, an immediate impact, not something we're talking about in the future, but everyone's been impacted by this on the planet. So how do we treat that as a value? How do we want to build back thinking of, we can't deal with coronavirus without bringing everyone along with us. We can't deal with it in one country. It doesn't work that way. We've seen that. So whether we like it or not, these governments are going to have to work together. This is, again, another opportunity to build those coalitions. And so many people have been impacted disproportionately. We've all got different experiences in our communities, in our movements, in our countries. But it's something we all have to deal with together, whether it's gender inequalities, whether it's racial inequalities, or whether it's class inequalities. They all have to be dealt with as we adjust and fair recovery.
Thank you, Jamie. With your answer, Jamie, we are coming to the end of this show. It was a very, very interesting reflection of you, but also all what our guests shared with us during the show. And that's why we would like with Madeleine to thank you, Jamie, Jason, Mina, and of course also Amos. I think it has been a very, very deep analysis and reflections on the COVID crisis, the implications it has had in the different countries, the different kind of consequences, the responses from the governments, and also the consequences of these responses. And also very interesting what we heard about how our communities and organizations in different parts of the world have faced all these challenges. I will leave you the floor, Madeleine. From my side, thank you. Thank you very much. We really appreciate your time.
Yes, of course. I want to also reiterate what Jose said, like so much thanks to our participants and for all the insights they shared. I mean, we've heard today from people in the UK, in Ghana, in Malaysia, in Philippines. This is only one of three shows which we will do. The next one will be with in Spanish and another one we will do in French. So we will also be hearing from people in other areas of the world. So thank you again. I just want to add that I agree. It's been a really fruitful exchange. You know, we came together to share experiences, to learn about how COVID-19 has affected us as individuals, communities, as organizations, and as people in different regions and countries. We've heard as much about how crisis has exposed the inequalities and injustices and fragilities of the current system, but also how there is that hope and that optimism that this could be an opportunity for building societies and economies which are based on justice, which are based on care and kindness, as Jamie said. And really, we have to be optimistic that we can work together in solidarity to build something better.